Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear David Frum, former speechwriter for President Bush, in conversation with Arianna Huffington, co-host of Left, Right, and Center on KCRW 89.9 FM, Public Radio's popular political roundtable program. Frum argues that Republicans, like the Democrats before them, have been the victims of their own success. He outlines a fresh vision of a GOP that can rebuild the conservative majority and elect the next Republican president. This program was originally produced on January 16, 2008. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here and to have a chance to have a conversation with David, whom I've known for many, many years through many incarnations, from the time I was a Republican living in Washington. For a period, David was the right on Left, Right, and Center. And his wife, I'm very happy to say, is one of our prominent bloggers on the Huffington Post, Danielle Crittenden. So I'm really very happy that David has written a book called Come Back, Conservatism That Can Win Again, which I see as a kind of a halfway station between his book, The Right Man, which came out in 2003, and his book, which I predict will come out about 2012, called Right is Wrong. So, you know, since I've made that journey myself, I just want to reassure David that the waters are fine here, and the people are friendly, no sharks. Now, I don't know what the composition of the audience is, but it doesn't matter, because we'll find out by the questions and by the response to what David has to say. But I think in any case, it's a really, really fascinating book to have David, who from the early days of the Bush presidency was the big cheerleader of what George Bush was doing, and now come to see what went wrong, what didn't work, and how, as you put it, conservatism can come back again and win in 2012. It's kind of interesting. He doesn't say in 2008, but in 2012. So, David, let's start with that. Why do you not?
Well, I don't give a number. I worked in an earlier phase of my career at the Wall Street Journal, and my old boss, Bob Bartley, gave me this rule about financial forecasting. That if you give a number, don't give a date. And if you give a date, don't give a number. And so I'm saying that there's no date here. Maybe 2012, it may be 2016, but it could be.
The date on the back of the book, though. But that could be the publisher.
Yeah, that's the publisher's New York optimism. They have, I want to say thank you first to you for coming, because I realize that, speaking of journeys, you've come all the way from Brentwood, which is much farther than the left-right journey that
especially at this time of day.
It's one of those trips that you think of where you say, well, you know, actually, as the crow flies, it really isn't that far. On the other hand, it wasn't that far from Gallipoli to Constantinople either. But the British had some trouble with that trip. The point of this book, this book is about, I think, two things. One obvious, one maybe not so obvious. The obvious thing is it is an attempt to offer solutions to Republicans in a time when the party is in a lot of trouble. Second, and this is a thing I have had more trouble with explaining to some of my Republican friends, it's also an example of a kind of method that I want to see people use in politics. That is to say that one of the things that has really gone wrong with the Republican Party in recent years is it's not empirical enough. It doesn't begin with the problem and work its way to a solution. And so what I say to a lot of my the book has attracted more criticism than applause on the Republican side of the aisle, which I'm used to. But what I keep saying to my Republican friends is, look, you don't have to buy anything I say, but copy the method. If you don't like my answers, use this. Start with the data and work your way forward. What we tend to do as a party too much is to begin with our own, and you know this well, you'll remember, begin as a kind of deduction. You begin by positing your ideological point, and then you sort of draw conclusions from that. And I sort of sum this up with, I worked in the White House with Karen Hughes, and we didn't always get along so well, I have to admit. And she wrote a book, and I don't think it's that good a book, but there's one good story. There's one good story, and I'll save you all 16 hours and $27.95 by poaching it, which is she's left the White House in 2003, and she's walking on the beach in Galveston, Texas, and she looks up, and there's one of those planes with the advertising slogans behind it, and it's dragging a sign that says, "Jill, come back. I am desolate without you, Jack." And she thinks, "Bad message, Jack. Too much about you, not enough about her."
You know, that is very interesting what you said about data and empiricism, because one of the problems with the Bush years has been this war on science and war on facts. And I wrote a book called Fanatics and Fools, and I consider this problem with data the kind of distinguishing characteristics of fanatics, if you think of it, because when you decide this is my ideology, this is what I believe, and then don't allow the evidence to make you change course. Isn't that what fanaticism is about?
Well, fanatics do that, but a lot of people who are not fanatic, I mean, it's a very natural human fault, and you don't have to be a fanatic to ignore unwelcome information. People manage to do that all the time. But even, because it's also in government, it's kind of difficult. One of the examples I often give about the failure of the way to use information was, one of the things that was a signature idea of the Bush administration was this idea of a faith-based initiative as a way of doing social services. You were very interested in this at one time.
That, still am, actually.
And here was the basis for it. What they discovered, what some smart social scientists like John DiIulio discovered, was that you could go to particular churches and people would, with very limited resources, get much better results treating drug addiction, mentoring children, than would be got by a social services agency. And so this was very exciting, understandably, because these are very hard conditions to treat. You're dealing with some very difficult population. So people got very excited about these discoveries. And so the assumption was, well, if we have one church treating drug addicts and getting better results than the program, what if we had 1,000? Wouldn't that be even better? And George Bush got very excited, and a lot of people got excited, and then this became Republican Party doctrine that we would do this. Now, this is not fanatical, but there are a couple of questions you have to ask along the way, which is it true that if one church does it and you get result X, that if 1,000 churches do it, you get results 1,000 times X? Maybe, to use the language of the Silicon Valley, maybe it's not scalable. I mean, maybe there's something that is special about that place. And that's the kind of thing, before you spend a whole lot of money, that's the kind of thing you want to check. Well, that didn't happen. The program was rushed ahead. And sure enough, what you discovered was the moment you made it big, they got exactly the same results, and maybe a little bit worse than the regular providers did, because they're magic people. And you can't summon up magic people.
Well, let's start with foreign policy, and then we'll go back to domestic policy. Because, of course, one of your claims to fame, which you explain in the book, is having been one of the authors of the president's famous speech that included the line about the axis of evil, which you explain in the book originally was the axis of hatred.
And which I really, it's one of these classic Washington stories where all the things you actually do, nobody pays any attention to, and then you become world famous for something you didn't do.
So tell us about it. I mean, it's a very interesting story.
But that means I have to surrender my claim to fame.
Don't worry, you can never surrender it.
You'll keep my secret. The phrase, of course, comes from the 2002 State of the Union address. Just the timeline is important. It's September 11th of 2001. Then the troops go to Afghanistan. The Afghan war begins in October. And by middle of November, all of the cities of Afghanistan have fallen. And the Taliban resistance looks very broken. The remnants have fled into the hill country between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it looks like this whole thing is winding up. And around the 1st of December, when work on the State of the Union began, the question is, well, what should the president say? And it was a very open-ended conversation. I mean, the White House was really baffled. And there was a big constituency in the White House for saying, that's it, the war on terror is over. Let's just declare it over and get back to our domestic agenda. Wars are risky. It might go badly. We've won. Now close the whole thing. And there are other people who took the problems have barely begun. We've barely begun to address them. So the question that was presented to me was, if the president decides he wants to, if he decides for option B, which at that point was not clear that he would, but if he decides to continue to have an active foreign policy, what would he do? What would he say? Write us something that sort of shows what it would be. But we're not going to share with you, of course, any details of what he actually has in mind. So you're right. So you're writing this sort of in a very abstract way, with no actual, without knowing what the policy actually is, because of course, because it's secret and the president has made up his mind. So one of the things that I was supposed to talk about was the relationship between all of the potential bad actors in the terrorist world. Now, at that point, we were beginning to get the first briefings on the Ahmad Khan network, which is this network of, you know, I think this is now very famous. This is the Pakistani scientist who was involved in brokering, partly for ideological reasons, partly for money, transmissions of missile technology and nuclear technology. And between a lot of different, I mean, North Korea was involved, and Pakistan and Iran. So how do we talk? And it was not clear to me how far the president would want to go. When I wrote about this, I talked about groups and countries. I did mention Iraq and others, you know, to be mentioned according to whether the foreign policy people want to mention them or not, who were, for all of their ideological differences, united together by their hatred in this axis of hatred against the United States. So that goes into the process, and we then revise it. And writing speeches for a president is like writing for the movies. I mean, there's writer. I guess I shouldn't use that analogy this week. There's no union, but
less money.
There's a lot less money, but there are a lot of people involved, and it's very modular. You write bits and chunks, and they're also then assembled together. And out of this came that State of the Union. Now, one of the things that when it happened, when the president said these words, I was very excited because I was and am a believer in a very active foreign policy on this war on terror. But I assumed, and this just gives you an idea of the compartmentalized nature of a White House, that when the president made the decision to name so many countries, that reflected some operational plan. Presumably, he would not have done it if he didn't have a clear idea of what, he would not have said it if he didn't have a clear idea of what he was going to do. And one of the things that's become, one of the things that became apparent to me in 2003-04 was that he had no actual plan to deal with Iran. And there are a lot of people on the Huffington Post who get very agitated about the coming war with Iran, which has been coming and coming like Christmas, except Christmas comes annually. And I've been writing since 2004, it's not going to happen. And it looks like it's really not going to happen. And at this point, I think it probably can't happen. And at this point, I think under the circumstances, I mean, it would be a big mistake if it happened in this presidential term. We have to. I believe it is a big, big problem if the Iranians get a nuclear bomb, and there seems to be very little let up in their determination, at least to acquire the nuclear fuel that is the key component of the bomb.
But to go back to that moment in history when the White House wasn't sure which way to go, and you're saying that there are some people who wanted a sort of very activist foreign policy against the war on terror, and others wanted to declare victory. So could you tell us who was on which side?
Some of that is actually, well, no. I mean, Karen Hughes was, for example, one of those who said...
Enough. A little
more
about Jill, a little less about Jack.
Exactly. The vice president was one of those who said, this is what's going to define us. Karl Rove, who often gets a lot of credit for deciding everything in the White House, was very much on the fence on this one and being very careful about whether to express an opinion or not, because when the president and Rove had this very complicated relationship, and wherever Rove asserted himself in places thought that he shouldn't, he would get slapped down very hard and often quite brutally. So he was not a tremendously active force in all of this until after the decision was made. I think the real contest was within the mind of the president. And it was within the mind of the country as well. I mean, I think had George Bush gone with the advice he was getting to say, well, that's it, the war is over, I think there would have been a tremendous feeling of letdown in the country, because what would have happened was so not proportionate to what was done to the United States.
Right. So Would you say that Dick Cheney has been to a large extent responsible for a lot of what happened that you are decrying now in the book, especially for the way the war was conducted, and we'll get to that in a minute?
No, I have to say there is very little in this book that is a backward look at the White House, and that's for two reasons. One is I wrote a book about it, and I said all the things that I was going to say while people were in office, and I've got more things I may someday say in another form. But I'm sort of done with that chapter. Second, other people have written so exhaustively about this, I can't believe there's any interest left in who said what. And I worry also, I've seen how these things get done, that it's very hard to rise above your own feelings and the being a prisoner of your own sources. This is the Bob Woodward problem. Woodward is an extreme case where in the last volume of his many volumes of the Bush White Houses, there's one case where somebody I know a little bit is described in one place as a total idiot and in another place as like one of the great unheralded stateswomen of our time, because he's just at one point reporting based at the point where she was still refusing to talk to him. And then later on, she did talk to him. And so he puts in a bunch of compliments. And then he doesn't even go back and revise the previous negative assessment of her in the place where she wasn't talking.
Does he name her?
Yeah, Megan O'Sullivan, who was the national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan. And one page, if you look around, there are two references, one Megan O'Sullivan moron and the other Megan O'Sullivan genius. So I don't want to do that. But also, I think a lot of the problems that I'm talking about in this book are really in pre-Bush. And I think I'm arguing a little bit with my own part. There are a lot of people in our part, and Bush is not very popular among Republicans now either. And I recently got an email from a friend of mine who had served in quite a senior position. The president had done something, and he sent me a note that said, he lost me with that remark. And if he's lost me, he's down to the military families and the Pentecostals. But there's a lot of feeling in the Republican Party that all we need to do is to see the back of George Bush and then say the words Reagan, Reagan, Reagan over again, and our problems will be over. And I think that in a way, for my purposes in this project, that talking too much about the White House will distract the audience I'm trying to reach by making them fail, by preventing them from understanding that they've got bigger problems than George Bush, older problems than George Bush, and in a curious way, George Bush, whatever you think of him, was an attempt to solve those problems. He was the nominee in 2000 precisely because many people in the Republican Party had decided that the Reagan ways weren't going... Well, whatever you think of the Reagan philosophy, the Reagan policies were not so applicable to the problems at the moment.
Because, you know, at the heart of your book is this belief that the problems we're facing now cannot be solved with the solutions that had made the Republican Party so successful at the polls for so long. And you talk about an intellectual exhaustion.
Yes. Well, look, when I got involved in Republican politics in the late 70s and early 80s, conjure up the world of 1980. As I look around the room, I realize most of us were there.
No, she wasn't.
Most, not all. Most of us were there very youthfully in high school, but we were there. Okay. So the American economy has just been through its worst decade since the Great Depression. We have very sluggish economic growth for a long period of time. We have inflation. We have unemployment. We have a failure of American industrial enterprise. We have real questions as to the competitiveness of the American economy as a whole. We have gas shortages. We have tremendous pessimism among people that the living standards in the future will be better. We have tremendous civil disorder, breakdown of the family. We feel we're losing in the great power competition with the Soviet Union. There's this terrible crime problem, a whole series of very specific social maladies for which the conservative movement came together to offer solutions. And they were the result of 15 years of intellectual work, and the conservative solutions worked. With the problem was, how do you stop inflation? There was a tremendous argument between Milton Friedman and John Kenneth Galbraith. Do you use wage controls or do you use monetary instruments? Friedman won the argument so completely we forgot it ever occurred. There are people like James, there was an argument over crime in which the dominant academic criminologists debated people like James Q. Wilson. Can you deal with a crime problem without changing the way cities are designed and the way welfare is administrated? Wilson said you can deal with crime just as crime. Others said you couldn't. He was right. They were wrong. He won the argument. There are arguments about could you ever make the American economy or American labor factor productivity grow again at more than 3.5%? The dominant view of people like Lester Thoreau was you could not do it. And then there were people like George Stigler who said if you deregulated the economy enough, it could happen again. And they were right. And the argument has largely been forgotten, and so on and so on and so on. And these were tremendous achievements. Now, it's 2008. We have new problems. But that kind of creative impetus that was there in the late 1970s is no longer there. People do not worry about, is American enterprise competitive? No one worries that American companies can't do a good job. People believe American companies do a good job, and they're very competitive, and the American economy is growing strongly, and we have left behind a lot of the crime problems, and the Soviet Union, of course, is in the dust. But we have other problems, and this is, we have wage stagnation because productivity gains are being devoured by the cost of health insurance. We have this tremendous immigration problem, which divides Republican constituencies one from another. We have seen a restabilization of family life at the top of society. That if you look at divorce rates for women who graduated from college in 1979 and compare them to divorce rates for women who graduated from college in 1991, we see the divorce rate has plunged by 2/3 for college-educated women, but it's flat for non-college-educated women. So they are still living, the bottom half of America is still living in the social turmoil of the 1970s. And to these problems, I don't know there are a lot, anyone has answers to it, but I know that our conservative world is not so good at answering them.
And just before we abandon foreign policy in Iraq, the problems that we see there, that have basically consumed not just so many of our resources, but our attention, are still there. And do you see any fresh thinking among conservatives?
About Iraq or about
Iraq and the war on terror generally?
Well, it seems to me that this may be one of the places where the conservative world has a different perception of things from other people. The general view in among conservatives is that the news from Iraq is getting better. And that is the great driving factor in the primaries. It's the reason why John McCain is suddenly a candidate again. And it's the reason why Rudy Giuliani, to whom I've been giving some advice, has dropped, because Giuliani, who is unacceptable to many Republican interest groups in many ways for his views on abortion and other social issues, he's the guy you turn to if you feel it's an emergency. Break glass, in case of emergency, break glass, take this guy. You may be uncomfortable with his view, but he can get things done. They don't feel it's an emergency anymore, and they're rewarding McCain, and they're reverting to their normal habits.
isn't that a... not looking at the data, because wasn't the search from the beginning sold to the American public as the way to buy time, to give some breathing room to the Iraqi government to bring some stability and democracy? None of these benchmarks have been met.
We got this tremendous piece of good luck that has, I think, very little to do with the surge, which is the surge happened at about the same time as the tribes that had been supporting the insurgency decided, largely for their own reasons, not to do it anymore. I don't know that that had anything to do with American policy, except for this one thing, that one of the things that in history the United States has always gotten done well by is because we tend to fight really nasty people. Sooner or later, you can count on them to do really nasty things. And Al-Qaeda in Western Iraq, they did really terrible things to the local people. And eventually the local people rebelled, and it is to that rebellion that we owe the success of the surge. We owe the seeming success of the surge. Still, nobody ever questions if it works. People don't and study the engineering too closely. We got something happened that benefited us, and it looks reasonably enduring. Certainly enduring enough that the hope you mentioned that there's time now to cobble something together. We'll see. I mean, there's an opportunity to cobble something together. But you're right. I mean, it's inconceivable to me that this number of troops can stay in Iraq for very much longer.
Well, especially when we have all these major problems we're facing in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the opportunity cost of being in Iraq is Afghanistan falling apart.
Well, it's not clear to me that we could have... It's not clear to me that we have military options in any of those places, and certainly not in Pakistan. But I mean, the option we have is very. Iraq is very expensive. It's very demoralizing for the American military. But it is damaging, I think, in many ways to our position in the world, but in a different way. Not because I think people object to. Had it been successful, it wouldn't have been. The UN things wouldn't have mattered. But we don't look very effective. And when you don't look effective, that's very damaging to your prestige. And meanwhile, one of the problems that Iraq was supposed to solve, I've always believed that one of the really important motives that led the president into Iraq was a belief that Saudi Arabia was on the verge of collapse. And that the pressures the United States was going to have to put on Saudi Arabia to defeat Al-Qaeda, which was so interpenetrated into the ruling classes of Saudi Arabia, might well topple that regime. And that the prospect of having Iran and Iraq be under hostile governments and have Saudi Arabia maybe collapse under the pressure of dealing with Al-Qaeda, that was just too frightening. And that in order that as a sort of insurance against what might be happening in Saudi Arabia, you had to turn Iraq politically. And that plan obviously didn't work. I mean, that Iraq remains not a strong American ally. And oddly enough, Saudi Arabia has somehow contrived to stumble through.
But there's no different thinking, intellectually or pragmatically, within the conservative movement or the Republican Party. I mean, you look at all the major candidates, and with the exception of Ron Paul, who is now ahead of Rudy Giuliani, there's nobody who is putting any distance between themselves and the president. I mean, except in symbolic ways, like Mitt Romney yesterday in his acceptance speech mentioned the president's father, but not the president. And when he was asked whether it was a mistake, his staff said, no, it was intentional. But there is no distance being put between the president's foreign policy and the candidates, which is amazing.
Well,
we've
had a sea change in where the foreign policy of the Republican Party is, and I think whoever is the Republican nominee, I shouldn't say that because I think actually Romney's views are fairly different from the president's. Giuliani's and McCain's are more or less convergent with his, maybe in fact even more so, more skeptical of Saudi Arabia, more skeptical of Pakistan. I think Romney probably, there are a lot of hints in the Romney material that his views are more distant from the president and more like his father. I mean, I think it didn't happen by accident, for example, that he's the only one of the Republican candidates who was invited to give a lecture at the father's presidential library. That's where he gave his, the connections between long-time Bush family people and the they are mostly going to the Romney campaign.
That's interesting. So what made you go to Giuliani?
I ended up with Giuliani, I think in largest part because my voting issue in this election has been the ability to manage the executive branch of the government, to make it do things. And Giuliani is the greatest public sector executive of our time. I mean, of all the people in this race, he is the one who, as a public sector executive, got things done. Not to disparage what Mitt Romney is, he has real accomplishments, but more of his are in the private sector. As a public executive, the Giuliani record is by far and away the best. And maybe a little naively, I hoped I could persuade my fellow Republicans to overlook the fact that they disagree with him, but half the things in his platform. so far, they don't see the need for him. They do not believe that the country, the party, is in enough trouble to turn to him. You know, there's a story, I don't know if it's true, I read it somewhere, I think it's true, that at like one of the dark moments in the Battle of Britain that Winston Churchill called the head of the British prison service and said, I want every forger, every safe cracker, every embezzler released and handed over to the SOE for secret missions in Europe. And like, that's what you do when your back is against the wall. You turn like, even the most unlikely sources of talent. And I think that for the Republican Party, the question is, does the Republican Party feel the moment where we need to get talent wherever we can get it? We don't care how many wives the guy has.
I can just see David kind of writing advertising material for Giuliani. Break glass. In fact, what is interesting is that on the social issues, all along, you have consistently been pro-choice, for example. I mean, the first time actually you and I met a few centuries ago, we were talking about choice in the Republican Party. And that has not changed. And in fact, this is part of what you're writing about in the book, the need for the Republican Party to have a new position on choice.
Well, this is a very difficult sell to some of my Republican friends. But here's the official position on the politics of abortion. The Republicans will say, well, look, it is true that when you look at the poll numbers, they show there are more Americans who are pro-choice than pro-life. And when you do a better poll, and because people don't break down quite so neatly as that, and you give people 7 or 8 choices, what you find is, you know, that they're still, it is all tilted toward the more pro-choice side of the spectrum. However, only about 12% of the public votes first on the issue of abortion. Only about 12% is the top issue. And for those people, there is a pro-life majority. In fact, among the people who vote on the abortion issue first, pro-lifers outnumber pro-choicers 2-1. Therefore, it's been an issue that has been helpful to the Republican Party. And that actually is a pretty convincing argument. I think that has been true. The question I raise in the book is, yes, that's true so long as Roe v. Wade is there. That's the reason pro-choice people don't vote on abortion, because it's a pretty hypothetical problem. Now, we are probably one Supreme Court nomination away from Roe v. Wade being overturned. If the Republicans win in 2008, even if the nominee is Rudy Giuliani, he has committed to choosing conservative judges, and the conservative judges are all united that Roe v. Wade is bad law as law. So it'll be overturned, at which point the power to regulate abortion, as I think everyone here understands, that doesn't mean abortion disappears, that means the power to regulate abortion returns to the states. Suddenly, it's not an abstract issue anymore. Suddenly, it's very particular. Suddenly, abortion becomes what temperance was in the 19th century. I mean, a hugely important issue in local politics. It disappears from national politics, probably. That's right. But every governor's race, every state assembly race, every state senate race is going to be about abortion, at least for a decade or so, until the different states work out where they stand on this. And you're going to energize out of that a grassroots or a local movement that is going to be very focused on the abortion issue, and it is going to breed a backlash that is going to make the anti-Roe backlash of 1973 look like child's play, because there are just so many more people who share that point of view. And that's something you really need to think about in advance. I think a lot of liberals on the abortion issue would say if they had it to do all over again, they would have let the air out of Justice Blackmun's tires on his way to the Supreme Court that day in 1973. Because had Roe v. Wade not happened, it was Roe v. Wade that created the Right to Life movement. Something was done that was done in a way that people perceived as illegitimate. And it energized this movement that has been hugely important. I give a list in the book of the U.S. senators who have lost their seats primarily because of the abortion issue, almost all of them on the pro-choice side. And it's like there are like 30 of them between 1976 and today. It's really amazing how many scalps are on that wall. That will be reversed. And that is something that Republicans really need to think very hard about and start planning now for the post-Roe world. I mean, I think Roe v. Wade is bad law, too. I'm a bit too much of a stare decisis guy that if I were a judge in that unlikely situation, I don't know if I would vote at this late date to overturn it, but I certainly would never have joined the Roe majority had I been there in 73. But you have to think about in the post-Roe world, then what happens? And what does that mean politically? And it's going to be a very dramatic event that I don't think many Republicans are prepared for.
Well, of course, you are the product of a very strong mother who was presumably pro-choice, wasn't she?
Mezzo-mezzo.
Not sure?
Not sure. But probably not really, no. But the thing about this is now two more family. My mother's one of these people. My mother was a prominent broadcaster in Canada, and she was the host of a show called As It Happens, and then a TV show called The Journal. As It Happens was the progenitor for All Things Considered. If you hear that, All Things Considered is a knockoff of it.
And she's also on a postage stamp.
That's right.
And has a library named after her.
Yeah, she was a very big deal. And she was, but she was one. The thing about her, and she died in 1992 at the age of 54, is. You never quite knew how she had this very unusual analytic mind. And so I can't quite answer that question, but because if you talked to her about abortion, I think probably in the end she would have pulled a lever for it. But she always saw things in very unusual ways, and it's often quite hard to know exactly where she would come down on the issues of the moment.
In fact, if we can move a little bit to David's personal life. He is surrounded by strong women. You know, his mother, his sister.
Yes.
Is a wonderful journalist.
Thank you.
His wife, very strong, and again, a wonderful writer. And his 16-year-old daughter.
Actually, it's the 6-year-old who is the real. She's the one we all work for.
So, but you've always been very comfortable with strong women.
Well, I don't know that that's...
Except for Karen Hughes.
But she wasn't a strong woman, actually. She was a very insecure woman. Look, one of the things that strong people do is they relish hearing from people who disagree with them.
Yeah.
Because you can take it, right? I mean, that one of the things that when I'm going to move. He said, moving the conversation away from his private life.
Don't worry, we'll move it back.
I am one of the things I became very interested in after I left the White House is a very obscure subject: the origins of the White House staff system. And there's a TV show about it, but it was basically the staff as we know it was invented by President Eisenhower, and he borrowed it from his military. It's not an accident the terminology is on military, because he replicated what the staff system he had used in the campaign in Europe and brought order to the highly chaotic White House left behind by Franklin Roosevelt. And Eisenhower had a set of rules. I mean, one of his rules was whenever you have a meeting, the most junior person speaks first. And you start with the most junior person, and you work your way up to the most senior person. And that the president always speaks last, and usually doesn't speak at all. Because once the president speaks, that's what everybody thinks. And so you need to avoid that at all costs. You know, Hugh Grant, I once heard Hugh Grant, when he was doing his atonement series of interviews, he talked about the people he said, the people I pay to lie to me. And presidents are surrounded by people they pay to lie to them. And it's to avoid being told lies is very, very difficult. So when you talk about strong personalities set these things up so that they hear what they don't think they want to hear, but they need to hear. And organizing systems, and it's precise, and the thing that is most challenging is everybody says, I love criticism. I welcome criticism. Everybody loves criticism until they get it. Then they don't like it so much. They want it to be fair. They want it to be fair criticism. They don't want it, but the moment at which the president most needs to hear something unpleasant is the moment at which he is most resistant. So unless you have built systems and rules that bring it forward, it's not going to happen. And in the Bush White House, we didn't have sufficient systems to do that. And we had a lot of people who were not strong people. They had the appearance of strength, but not the reality of it.
Well, that's very interesting. And that, of course, is why you are a student both of politics and of human nature. And I particularly enjoyed when we had a competition on the Huffington Post as to who was going to be chosen as the most comical, mockable president. And most people were invited to participate. It was in celebration of Danielle's book about IMs, presidential IMs, which was a concept that she came up with. And most people came up with Richard Nixon, and a couple of them had Ford. And David came up with William Henry Harrison, who, as he put it, basically died of his own pomposity. Because remember, he was the guy who gave the speech without the overcoat and died of pneumonia.
The world's the longest inaugural address ever recorded.
By the shortest president, right?
That's right. William Henry Harrison is, remember the Tippecanoe and Tyler Too, the log cider campaign, the log cabin and hard cider. So they'd run Harrison as this, you know, creature of the Wild West. Harrison, of course, was from a very prominent Virginia aristocratic family. He was born in Berkeley Plantation. He had a fine classical education, and it just made him sick that his campaign managers were representing him as an uneducated backwoodsman. So when he won, he then decided to do this inaugural address that, you know, began with reflections on Cicero and worked its way forward to Athenian democracy, pausing through some of the leading British political theorists of the 18th century. It was 3 hours, and he showed it to Webster, and even Webster, who gave a long speech, was aghast and pleaded with him to cut it, but he didn't. And he gave this thing in the Washington March without an overcoat because he was also the oldest president and was vain about that and didn't want to look sick. And he caught a cold and died. I mean, it's sad, of course, but it's very sad. But
now, we mentioned that you were born in Canada, and in fact, up until very recently, you were a Canadian.
That's right.
So this is kind of the lead into immigration, because you just...
Two of us doing jobs Americans won't do. Actually, I think there are probably a lot of Americans who do this.
Yes, except that I became a naturalized way before you, because... You actually took the oath.
They lost my file.
September 11, 2007, right?
And it was a true INS amazing story, where they lost the file and then it's not possible. I mean, it's so boring, but anyway, I took it. I signed the papers after I had a hard time making up my mind to do it, but I signed the papers after the 9/11 attacks to begin the process, and it did not complete until September 11th. Which is kind of corny, but that's the way it was of 2007.
But there's no problem about not being American and working at the White House.
You know, this is an amazing thing. It's complete. Weirdly enough, it turns out it's complete. If you have the papers to work at Taco Bell, you can work at the White House. I had a green card, but here's the catch. It's the catch, which is the security regulations tightly regulate the ability of foreigners to enter the complex or to wander around unescorted. And so, as it was explained to me by a friend of mine who was a junior White House counsel, well, the rule is you can have the job, but you can't come to work. And I have a number of friends who are sort of employers who say, I have a lot of employees who'd like that deal. we eventually did sort it out. But it took a lot of paperwork to make it happen. I never had a security clearance when I was there, though.
So one of the issues, actually, that you deal with a lot in the book is immigration.
Right.
So, and you actually disagree with the president's position on immigration and John McCain's position on immigration.
Yes, everybody's.
Every other candidate agrees with you, more or less.
No, they don't.
Okay,
they don't.
Tell us.
It's all
tell
for show.
The differences.
Okay. Here's the way I think. Since... I think people don't... Let's start with sort of the scale of this. Since 2000, about 8 million people have migrated to the United States, half of them illegally. Since 1970, about 40 million people have migrated to the United States, about a third of them illegally. Now, this massive post-70 migration is very different from the migration that occurred in the last century or occurred before 1970, because its defining characteristic is it is overwhelmingly of very, very low skills. Three quarters of the migrants come from Mexico and Central America, and we're talking typically about people with grade 3 and 4 educations. The result of it has been when you bring people with very low skills into an advanced industrial economy, they find it very hard to get their foot onto the ladder onto the escalator, and they don't perform well economically. Immigrants who arrived in the United States before 1970, within 10 years, typically made more money than native-born people. And that's still true, by the way, in Canada and Australia, where immigrants within 10 years make more money because they take more people, but they emphasize skilled migration. In the United States, that's not true. Immigrants, post-1970 immigrants never catch up to the native-born. And not only that, when you look at those from Mexico, their children and their grandchildren don't catch up to the native-born. And their demand... their consumption, once they become legal, while they're illegal, at least they are unable to use services, but once they are legalized, as inevitably they sooner or later are, they begin to demand very heavy levels of services because they're poor and they're now Americans and they're entitled. But the demand, the cost is not, I think, widely understood. It's very expensive. In fact, again, I quote that in the book, that over a lifetime, a household of Mexican immigrants, the average household of Mexican immigrants, will require $1.2 million in services, more than they pay in taxes. And just to put that in comparison, over their lifetime, the average college-educated family will pay about $1.2 million more in taxes than they collect in service. So it takes about one native-born college-educated family to support the demands of one migrant family. This is about the mismatch of bringing very low-skilled people into an advanced industrial economy. And it is having a big effect on American wages with a surprisingly small overall positive effect on the economy. The White House did, the Council of Economic Advisors, when they were pushing the president's plan, did a big study of the economic effects of immigration. And these are people who are supporting the president's plan, and they concluded that immigration, the present policy, conferred a net economic benefit on the United States of about $40 billion a year. Which sounds like a lot of money, except in the context of a $12 trillion economy, it's a little less than 3%. So that's the net economic benefit. Meanwhile, the way they arrived at this number was by using a formula that is generated by America's leading immigration economist, a guy called George Borjas. And I asked him to review the study, and he said, well, there actually was not enough material here to see exactly how they'd done it. But assuming that they did use his method correctly, and looking at the answer, doing the algebra, he then reverse engineered it and said, this implies that the way you get to a $40 billion net benefit is this implies a $400 billion gross benefit and a $360 billion gross loss. The net benefit, almost all of it accruing to the immigrants themselves and to owners of capital assets, the gross loss accruing almost entirely to wage earners. And just this, I know this is a lot
sounds
of
sounds just like Lou Dobbs, doesn't
okay.
it?
Okay. Just to complete the barrage of arithmetic, I'm sorry about this, but and to complete the barrage of arithmetic, and I hope I don't sound like Lou Dobbs.
No, you don't at all. That is the joke.
that $360 billion in gross loss to wage earners, the total wage bill of the United States is about $3.5 trillion. So that's a 10% reduction in wages, offset by a $400 billion increase in the value of capital assets and benefits to the migrants themselves. That is, I mean, it's a benefit, but the distributional effects of that are pretty shocking. And that's one of the reasons why it's not as important as healthcare, but it's one of the reasons why ordinary Americans, median Americans, are so upset about this issue. Now, it also explains why upper Americans, like the presidential candidates, like most of my friends, like me, tend not to be very upset about this issue because it does tend to drive up the value of capital assets. I remember once, without so much arithmetic, walking my 16-year-old daughter through this argument. They said it at school. She said, Daddy, why do people get so upset? So I tried as fairly as I could to present the pros and cons and, you know, who wins and who loses. And she listened to me and she said, well, Daddy, why are we against it? We're winners. But I think part of the effort of politics is to sort of look past what's good for you.
Well, I want to move on to a couple more questions before we open it up to everyone. But just one thing on immigration is the problem of all the data you're presenting and the thought that you put into it are not at all the way the issue is discussed. And that's why I brought up Lou Dobbs, which is really demagogued, and you really begin to have that sense of immigrants as a force that has to be resisted.
And of course it doesn't work. I mean, I actually, every time Lou Dobbs opens his mouth, he loses support. Because look, this is a very moderate country. This is a very, very rich country, and people have a lot to lose. And Americans like their institutions. They do not, and right now this is sort of a bad moment. There's a lot of people feeling they're on the wrong track. But basically, it's a status quo country. And if you look angry, if you look upset, if you look like, if you look unbalanced.
If you look like John Edwards.
It's hurt him. It's hurt him. And this has been the thing he hasn't been able to solve, is that when he looked happy in 2004, he had nothing to say. Now he has something to say, and he looks a little, scary. And this is the thing that, I mean, Obama does this. I mean, Mitt Romney just doesn't quite hit this quite right, but of making people not feel like you're so agitated all the time because people have a lot to lose. So I think in many ways on the immigration issue, the way you win the argument, I'm sorry about all that arithmetic, is being a little boring and saying, you know, that this is not because I'm agitated about, you know, that the world is changing, as the world always changes. I'm agitated because because Republicans need to be the party of the middle class, and they need, and I think there are two key prongs to what is eating at middle class incomes, and they are the healthcare problem and uncontrolled immigration.
And one last question from me before we open it up is about healthcare, because your position in the book is very unexpected, because you come down in favor of affordable healthcare for everyone.
Well, that's not. I hope that's not a controversial position. I think it is true that Republicans are in favor of affordable health care for everyone. The question is not, are you in favor of it, but what do you do? I mean, how do you do? What do you do about it?
Actually, have a plan.
And how much energy do you spend on that issue? And it's been an issue that Republicans do have plans, but it's never at the top of mind. And it's not the thing they lead their speeches with, and it needs to be, because it's the top of mind issue for the employers. I mean, the people who vote for you are the people you work for, and if they care about something, it's just generally never a good plan to say, boss, I know you think this is important, but you're mistaken. I mean, sometimes you can get away with it, but you don't make a career of it.
So, who wants to go first? Yes, here.
There's two agencies of the federal government, the CIA and the... The CIA...
I'll repeat the question.
The CIA and the Federal Reserve Board are two agencies of the federal government that are allowed to meet in secret. There's an act called the Federal Advisory Commissions Act. I preface my question with that is because a bill that passed the House by Jane Harman is now in the Senate. It's called Senate Bill 1959. It forms, and I've read a little of the history of the Joe McCarthy era, it forms a commission that goes around the country. It's called the Homegrown Terrorist Act, or the Homegrown Terrorism Commission Act. It's in Lieberman's committee right now, though. And it has a line in that bill that allows this commission to be excluded from the public process. As a conservative Republican, what do you think of Senate Bill 1959 and the line in there that allows the commission to meet in public and also in secret?
It comes as total news to me, so I can't have an opinion.
Yeah, well, the mainstream press, Philip Giraldi and Linda Milazzo at the have talked about this.
But, okay, thank you.
You've defeated me.
My question.
You managed to ask a question that he doesn't know the answer to, so that's quite an achievement. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
Speaking to your book, what the Republicans can do to save their party, so to speak, is that correct?
Yes.
It seems to me that the Republican Party needs to start working to at least appear to be in cooperation with the Democratic majority, particularly in the Senate, although it's so narrow that it almost isn't a majority, because the Republicans had set up a system now where no bill is going to pass the Senate unless you get the supermajority of 60. I mean, Mitch McConnell has said that openly and openly. The public is not going to sit still for it for much longer, and the Republicans, it seems to me, are going to pay the price in the November elections, because nothing is going through Congress anymore.
I tend to be a believer generally. I tend generally not to be a believer in bipartisanship, and I think that's because when you have two parties, that their job is to accentuate differences so as to make the act of voting more meaningful. And what happens usually, that what advocates of bipartisanship usually mean, or end up meaning, they don't consciously mean it, is you end up removing a lot of the power of democratic choice by blurring the difference between the parties. So if there are important pieces of, let us say that the Democrats have important pieces of legislation, which I don't think they do, but if they did, and if the Republicans, and if they were popular, and if the Republicans were stalling it, that would be a great political weapon for the Democrats. I think one of the reasons that the Democrats I know in Washington do talk a lot about this issue, but almost always entirely in procedural terms. And if you ask, the next time you hear about this, ask them, what is this great thing that the Democrats would do? It usually turns out to me, well, we'd stop the Iraq war, but those Republicans won't let us. But I don't think that is an honest reflection of where the Democratic senators themselves are. It's a little bit convenient to them as well.
Yes.
Hi. I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I've become a Republican so that I can vote for Ron Paul in the primary because he voted against the Military Commissions Act, the Patriot Act, the war. He, like I, have unanswered questions about the investigation of 9/11. He's concerned about the North American Union. How has the Bush administration's attack on the Constitution affected the image of the Republican Party?
I find people who support Ron Paul fall into two broad categories. Those who don't know a lot about him and those who do. And those who do and who continue to support him, I think are really beyond the reach of reason. But to those who don't, I really would recommend that you read Jamie Kirchick's article in The Last New Republic about who he is and what he believes and how he raises his money and who his associates are. And it's eye-opening reading, and I think will be very disturbing. My guess is that doesn't make much of an impression on you, that you probably know all of this already. Okay.
She'll read it.
Okay.
Yes.
What is the question?
About the impact of the administration's policies on the Constitution.
Okay, I talk a little bit in the book about one of the things that has been a problem is that the Bush administration worked out a series of ad hoc, impromptu responses to the problem of terrorism, a lot of which were, in my opinion, right on the merits, but which should have been done through Congress. And in the mood of emergency of 2001 and 2002, people went ahead and did things that they ought at some point over the past 6 years to have said, this is the moment to bring Congress in. That we need, because a lot of, I think, for example, the decision not to treat terrorist detainees as prisoners of war is very defensible. But you can't do it just as a matter of, it is, because if they're prisoners of war, you can't interrogate them. That's one of the things that the Geneva Convention says about prisoners of war. You can't ask them questions or anyway. You cannot deprive them of any of the benefits of prisoner of war status if they refuse to answer. You have to, by the way, prisoners of war are also entitled to be paid. They're entitled to have money forwarded to them from their government to be used for the purchase of small luxuries and so on. They're not prisoners of war. So you need a regime to govern how they're to be treated. It can't just be the work of the president if this is going to go on for years and years. So I tend to agree with the views of those who said, look, that there was a moment in 2003 or thereabouts to sit down with members of Congress and write a statute and to do the kinds of things that were done in 1946 when the Cold War began. So we need a set of rules to govern how the Cold War is going to be operated. The old rules won't work anymore. We need new rules, and I think that is true for the war on terror and the Bush administration. I don't see that as an attack on the Constitution. Others may disagree. I see that as a series of ad hoc solutions and a hyper-partisanship that refused to work with Congress and then, in turn, brought out the worst in Congress. And Congress, when you treat it as an irresponsible body, it often becomes a very irresponsible body.
Yes.
Over here. This is about tax cuts and something that has puzzled me for years, decades. We have a history, I think, starting with Coolidge after the First World War taxes. He cuts taxes. We have a tremendous growth expansion in the 1920s. Kennedy does it. Again, a tremendous increase, not just in growth, but in government revenues. This is maybe more my focus. And then, of course, Reagan, now Bush. And what has just stunned me is that throughout all of this experience, it seems to be totally ignored the tremendous benefit, I think, to the conservative cause. Cut your taxes, government revenues go way up because the economy gets much better.
Yeah.
And why is it never used? Only recently, give or take the past 3-4 years or so, has there been some recognition, only here and there, and I take note that it was never mentioned here by you either, that this is a tremendous benefit and weapon that can be used to increase the conservative cost. One very quick other thing, and I wanted to throw it off, totally different. To me, there is a very easy way to knock the stuffing out of the Taliban. And it's never brought up, maybe because it's politically unfeasible. And that is legalize heroin. All of their income comes from the drug war. We'd knock their financial support in pieces. Thank you.
All right. Well, you raised two very interesting points. Let me say, it is certainly true that there are circumstances under which if you cut a certain tax, you will get more revenue from that tax. Lots of examples of that. It's not, however, always true. It was true in 2001. I don't think that the math bears it out that the Bush tax cuts increased the revenues of the government. I think they had other economic benefits. But this is one of the ways that our world, I was talking about the world of 1980 versus the world of today. In the 1970s, we had, I now forget how many tax brackets, but a lot of them, like 11. And we had very swift inflation. So families moved very rapidly even if their income simply kept pace with inflation. Families moved rapidly from one tax bracket to another. Over the course of the 70s, there's a tremendous book written done about this by by the Urban Institute called The Tax Decade, which shows what happened to typical taxpayers through the 70s. The tax burden on the typical family approximately doubled between 1970 and 1980. The income tax burden, approximately doubled. So this was a huge issue. And Reagan's tax cuts were an enormous benefit to families at the middle. Over the years since then, we've had a series of tax cuts, both at the margin and then with the Bush tax credits of the Gingrich Congress in the middle 90s and then Bush, that have drastically lowered the income tax burden of middle-income families, to the point now where 80% of American families pay less in income tax than they do in payroll tax. And 29 million income-earning households pay no income tax at all. About the top 1% pays about almost 40% of the income tax, and the top 5% pays a majority of the income tax. Now, all of this means that for most people, the income tax is a very abstract matter. It's just not important to them. And what it also means is it's not quite clear that you're going to see dramatic results from cutting the income tax further. I think there are taxes where you can see a big result, but they tend to be taxes that are less exciting, like the corporate income tax, which is now higher in the United States than it is in France. If that were lower, and John Kerry, by the way, proposed that in 2004, that would have probably some very positive returns, but it's not sexy. And what we're at, and this is one of the reasons I think that the conservatives and the Republicans are in a bit of trouble, we have taken a policy, tax cutting, and we've made it a philosophy, but in the interim, because of our very success at tax cutting, the philosophy has become progressively of less interest to people. And the taxes that are most calling out for reform are the ones that are most boring. And so one of the things I suggest in the book is, I mean, I do have a series of supply-side tax cuts that I think Republicans should favor. But given that government spending is going to be rising dramatically because of the imminent retirement of the baby boom, it is just not going to be mathematically possible to cut these taxes without finding revenues elsewhere. And this is real Republican heresy, but if we're going to cut the corporate income tax, which I support, we have to find revenues elsewhere. And the two things I suggest are, one, we need to think about some kind of carbon tax, and two, or some other tax on energy, and two, we need to think about taxing upper income consumption, and we need to move to a consumption tax where And there are a lot of ways to do this, but where one way, for example, is if you make the this is maybe, again, more technical. You make the IRA infinite. You can put as much money as you want into the IRA, and you leave the income tax alone on everything that isn't in the IRA. You have turned the income tax into a consumption tax, and you can then make it quite progressive and then say, we'll tax, you know, if you spend more than X amount, you will face rates on your spending of 40-50% a percent, but all the things you save and invest are proceed free of tax, and that will help the economy to grow. But I think if the Republicans were to campaign in 2008 on a big tax cut, I don't know that they find a big public response for it.
One last question.
One last question, and then I'll give the last one to you after that, or Arianna, to end.
And then David is going to be signing books, so you can ask him questions while he's signing. He can multitask. Yes.
1 minute. You spoke a little bit earlier about the pro-choice people are outnumbering the pro-life people and that the moderate people are far outnumbering the extreme people. So with the abortion issue being important to a lot of people, can you be more revealing about your book and name the top three things that you think the Republican Party should do to appeal to all these people in the middle?
Well, On the abortion issue specifically?
No, anything.
My top three are, one, the Republican Party needs to make a commitment that it will make healthcare its top domestic issue, using markets, not government, competition, not state control. Immigration, an immigration policy designed to bring down the numbers of unskilled migrants. And I suppose, third, the Republican Party needs to reclaim its environmental heritage. You know, it's a very strange thing. It's like a secret history of the party, that of the major pieces of environmental legislation passed since 1965, I think all but one, Jimmy Carter's Superfund, were passed under Republican presidents. And yet, it's not something we talk about. I mean, it's something that we're kind of embarrassed about. Even though we have all kinds of information, this is the most important issue to the younger voters, and we are losing this generation of 20-somethings. One of the things that is really striking about the environmental issue is how, for many people, it's not, when you ask voters which candidate has the best record on the environment, they name Obama. Obama has zero environmental record. He's never done anything. I don't know that he's even ever given a speech about the issue, much less passed a piece of legislation. The person who gets the lowest rating on this issue is John McCain, who has the longest record of any of the present candidates. So what is this about? What it's about is the environmental issue is largely, because it's so important to young people, and because, forgive me for saying this, because young people tend not to be as well informed as older voters, it is an attitudinal question. That it is a way of connecting you to a general outlook rather than to any specific thing you've done. That means you, when you're trying to shift people, that you, I mean, in some ways it's hard, in some ways it's easy. You need an attitudinal shift to connect with people and to say, here are these things we've done, from the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the elder George Bush's actions on acid rain back in the 90s. We've got this whole long list. That's who we are. Talk about it.
I want to end by explaining why I think this is a very important book. It's not a book that I agree with and everything in the book, but it's extremely important because I think one of the most necessary things that we need to do is to move away from looking at American politics through this right-left prism. And I think one of the reasons why people reflexively think that Obama is better on the environment than John McCain is because the environment is seen as a left-wing issue. And I find it the most problematic way of looking at what we're trying to solve and moving forward in the next century. So I'm kind of really imposing certain rules. For example, at the Huffington Post, we are not allowed to use the terms right-left. And our reporters cannot just reflexively write about something being on the left. They have to find other ways to say something, because otherwise it becomes like just a way to avoid looking at problems with new ways and realizing that not everything is a right-left issue. healthcare is definitely not a right-left issue, but it is seen as a right-left issue by many people because it is seen as an issue which is on the left, even though the fact that, as David mentioned, employers, Detroit, automakers, are just as passionate about some solutions to healthcare as the uninsured. So maybe you can all help us in this movement to move away beyond that and then deal with our disagreements on the issues, like David and I disagree passionately still, even in this book, about the war in Iraq and the war on terror. But what David is writing about the environment, about healthcare, these are all issues that need to be debated vigorously, as opposed to the way that so many debate them in the media, which is, on the one hand, is Michael Crichton saying there is no global warming, and on the other hand is Al Gore saying there is, and these views are supposed to be equally valid. So I want to thank you, David, very much for writing the book, for coming out here, talking to us, and for being so wonderful with all the strong women in your life.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.